comes from the very ambiguity in the word security. If you think about security, it's a very funny word. Sometimes it means an objective, notably safety, and there's a huge literature about whether we're talking about the safety of the nation, the safety of the individual, the safety of the society, the safety of the planet, and with different recipes for what should be done. And at the same time, in ordinary parlance, it refers to security practices, whether we're talking about door locks, insurance, police, military forces, and that spawns a whole lot of different literature, including, for example, the securitization literature, that by performing security, I remind you of the importance of the state which is protecting you. So if we go back to the military forces analogy, by having exercises in the German plane during the Cold War, it reminded us that a third world war would be the worst thing that could possibly happen, and therefore we trusted our state to keep us safe. So what a security culture does is to bring together both objectives and practices more or less harmoniously. And oh gosh, I was going to actually read you a definition, my definition, but then it might take me too long to find it. I forgot to get it out. I wanted to read you a formal definition of how I've defined security cultures, but it may just, no, I think it's just too difficult to find it in my tablet. I should have put it on a piece of paper. But basically what it does is it brings together objectives and practices, but it is quite concrete. It brings together narratives, tools, apparatuses, infrastructure, which tend to shape both ways of thinking and ways of doing things and norms about what's right and what's wrong. Every security culture, for example, has its own set of rules. And understanding how the narratives and the rules are actually embedded in the practices helps to explain why we go on always doing the same thing. Why do we always go on having airstrikes against terrorists when actually they're not a very effective way of dealing with the problem of terrorism? And in the case of new wars, why do armed groups go on fighting when they have very little chance of winning? So how do these persistent ways of doing things keep going? That's what I'm interested in. And I think it's quite useful, just very briefly, to distinguish it from a term that's used in strategic studies, which is strategic culture. So strategic culture was kind of invented by the RAND Corporation because the Russians didn't act the way their game theorizing expected them to act. They expected them to respond to certain moves, and they didn't. And so they started to explain it in terms of what they called strategic culture. And that spawned a huge literature, which I won't go into here. Colin Gray is probably the most famous exponent of strategic culture. But I just want to, it's quite useful to talk about that to explain why my concept's different. And why is my concept different? First of all, it's not necessarily military. I'm interested in security cultures which either engage in or try to address political violence. And so some security cultures may be more policing or what I call the liberal peace, the UN type, peace agreement type security culture is not necessarily a military culture. So that's the first way it changes. Secondly, and this is probably more important, it's not national. Instead of being about the way in which military culture is imbued with national characteristics, it's about a way of doing culture. So if you think about cultures as having boundaries, then you can think that the man in the Pentagon, and it usually is a man, has more in common with the man in the Russian Ministry of Defense than he does with the peacekeeper or the humanitarian worker. And so it's about ways of doing things rather than about, it's a functional definition of culture rather than a national definition of culture. And the final difference, although not all strategic culture theorists would say it was a difference, is that for me, culture's constructed. So what's interesting about the concept of culture is how it gets reproduced and how it's constantly changing. Whereas the old strategic culture theorists tended to be a bit essentialist. So they would say, well, Britain has a navy because it's surrounded by sea and it's always had a navy. So that's a cultural explanation as to why Britain put so much emphasis on the navy. Whereas this kind of explanation, we would have to understand how is it that you get, in a constructivist approach, how is it that you somehow choose some traditions and not others? And which traditions do you choose to reproduce? And in the book, I define four cultures and I discuss each of them and I talk about their genealogy, their history, how they evolved to become what they are, that compete on today's landscape. And my point really is that whereas we tend to think, whereas in the Cold War, we actually had a single geopolitical security culture. That was the Cold War culture and everybody sort of agreed that the level of military spending and the number of military forces was a kind of measure, indicator of how much power you had. And because everyone shared that culture, and there was a set of beliefs that underpinned the role of military force, it was a rather stable system and that helped you identify the hierarchy of states. And instead today, I think we have four, I broadly define them, but they overlap, they change, competing cultures. And my cultures are geopolitics, which is the heritage of the Cold War, which still dominates defense budgets, new wars, the war on terror, and the liberal peace, which is the UN, the EU, the AU. And each of these cultures are deeply embedded in forms of political authority. So geopolitics is very much about the nation state, about blocs, about great powers. The war on terror is very much about US exceptionalism, although other countries are following. The liberal peace is about the emergence of international institutions and how they legitimize themselves. And new wars, which I'm going to talk about, is very much about what in the literature is referred to as hybrid authority, new types of formal and informal local authorities. So that's broadly my introduction to what I mean by security cultures. And now I just want to explain a little bit about new wars as a culture. So that's the next thing I'm going to do. And in terms of the genealogy, I think I want to say that new wars as a culture evolved, it's a form of irregular warfare, and irregular warfare being only defined when regular wars were defined. So although there are much earlier texts talking about irregular warfare, it really came into being in the 17th and 18th century with the rise of formal states and militaries, the rise of geopolitics, if you like. But I think in a lot of the literature, new wars are said to be civil wars, which I've always rejected, because I think new wars are a contrast both to interstate wars and the civil wars of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But I think that new wars evolved very much out of the interplay between revolutionary warfare and counterinsurgency. That's the origin, which was counterinsurgency largely international and revolutionary warfare. So they were, if you like, internationalized civil wars. And actually, I just came back from Colombia and was talking to Annette about it. And it's fascinating in the light of the evolution I'm going to talk about to think about Colombia in this light, because the Colombian War is the same war. It started as a classic left-right civil war, but gradually took on new war characteristics. So just very briefly, the story of this evolution. Revolutionary warfare began after the Second World War as a way of getting around concentrations of massive conventional wars. The revolutionaries knew they could never win if they directly opposed the state, because the state was so much stronger and more powerful. So the only way they could win was politically rather than militarily. They could win by controlling more and more territory. Politically. And so how did they do that? They established safe havens in the border areas, in jungles, on mountaintops, and even in cities, as was the case in Algeria, where they had the support politically of the local population. And from there, they carried out attrition attacks on strategic posts. And the idea was they would wear down the enemy and eventually they would win politically. Actually, Mao and the Vietnamese theorist, whose name I can never pronounce, did actually think at the end you'd require conventional warfare, as indeed was the case in both the Chinese and Vietnamese wars. But in general, the idea was that you won politically. Well, counterinsurgency developed in response to these wars, and you have the experience of the Portuguese in Angola and Mozambique, the British in Malaya, the French and Americans in Indochina, the French in Algeria, and you always had a division among counterinsurgency theorists between what nowadays is called the enemy-centric, more coercive approaches, in which you tried to kill as many revolutionaries as possible, and you tried to extract information through horrible forms of torture. And all sorts of techniques were developed in this enemy-centric, including population displacement, so that the people could no longer support the revolutionaries. They would poison the sea for the fish. Mao always said the guerrilla was a fish in the sea and the people were the sea. Sieges, the use of area destruction weapons to destroy crops and the things that people lived by, and what Brigadier Kitson called pseudo-gangs, which he developed in Kenya. Also, the French guerrilla counterinsurgency theorist Tranquier had these Maquis in Algeria who were sort of fake insurgents. I won't go into the population. Actually, all of these wars, the other approach was to try to compete through winning hearts and minds. And that was the approach, supposedly, of Templar in Malaya. Although wherever, if you look closely at all of these wars, you always find coercive tactics as well. So I think a very key moment was the 1980s. With the low intensity conflicts of the 1980s, what you got was sort of the multiplication of, if you like, pseudo gangs. Oh, fermenting sectarianism was another mechanism used as a form of counterinsurgency. And, you know, if you're talking about the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the Contras in Nicaragua, UNITAR in Angola, the paramilitaries in Colombia, they were local non-state actors who adopted the techniques of counterinsurgency. And I think it's out of that evolution that comes new wars. Now, along with that evolution, there's another element that you have to take into account, which is the changed economic and political circumstances. These were conflicts fundamentally about whether revolutionaries were opposing colonial or oppressive regimes. in the context of the 1980s, you had the opening up of authoritarian regimes, both economically and politically. And that process of liberalization created new factors which also contribute to new war. One is the way that the state greatly enriched elites. Whether it was through privatization, or whether it was through access to aid contracts, or whether it was through bribery related to arms sales, there were a whole lot of new mechanisms through which some kind of relationship with the state could lead to enrichment. My colleague Alex de Waal talks about the political marketplace really to describe the monetization of clientelistic relations. Most of these authoritarian regimes were based on clientelistic relations, but it became literally based on money after the 1980s, and competing for funds meant competing for access to the state. And in order to get access to the state, you actually needed the money. So even if you weren't fundamentally corrupt, you wanted some good program to introduce, actually you needed to have a political budget as part of your bargaining process in the government. And of course this was also linked to high unemployment and high inequality in many of these societies. Along with that, you had political liberalization and new demands for democracy. And what you notice is that many of the new wars actually begin as democracy movements. Whether you're talking about Ukraine, Bosnia, Syria, they start as democracy movements which are often addressed to these newly rich elites, and they get transformed into sectarian conflicts. And that's part of the new war process, which I'll come to in a moment. So these are the kind of conditions. And if I now talk about how did new wars differ from the civil wars of the 50s, 60s, 70s, it'll give you more of an idea of what I'm talking about. So first of all, obviously the goals. As I've said, the goals of the revolutionaries were social transformation. They had programs. They wanted to introduce socialist programs. They wanted to get control the whole state in order to carry out different policies. Whereas the goals of the new war actors are very much access to the state, because it's access to a form of revenue. So it's access to the apparatus of the state. You don't actually need to even control the state. And in fact, you probably benefit from the state being weak. Secondly, the actors. Who were the actors? So the actors in the civil wars were basically guerrilla revolutionaries who very much regarded themselves as soldiers. I was told by someone who was going through the archives of the Red Cross that they found a letter from Che Guevara asking how he should be treating his prisoners of war according to international humanitarian law. So they very much regarded themselves as an army in waiting. The actors in the new wars are networks of mercenaries, warlords, paramilitaries. But I think there's one very important difference which William Reno, who writes about war in Africa, draws attention to. In the 50s and 60s, sort of students sitting in the classroom would dream of being a left-wing guerrilla and would go to the mountains and start their movements. So the revolutionary movements were very much led by young intellectuals. After 89, those same students wanted to become civil society activists. They wanted to be support movements for democracy. And the warlord rebels very often came out of the government themselves. they were much more warlords. It was a different type of leadership altogether. They might be criminal gang leaders, mafia types, or local warlords. They were the ones who didn't want to lose their positions. And they often allied with what William Reno calls parochial rebels, vigilante gangs, local armed groups who join in with these networks. So the actors, and of course they are linked in various ways to global networks, which I can talk about in a minute. So the actors are different. Thirdly, the narratives are different. This is where we come to sectarianism. You know, I think sectarianism was, the manipulation of sectarian narratives has been very much a way of dealing with the democracy movements. You see it very clearly in Syria, and you also saw it very clearly in Bosnia, that whereas the democracy movements were, they called themselves the civic movements, they called themselves the multi movements, multicultural, multi-religious, multilinguistic. And the people who took part in the democracy protests were by and large not the same people who took part in the war. The war was fought very often by poor, unemployed young men who were drawn into the Bosnian army or the Croat or the Serbs and saw joining a militia as a source of income, and also often came from the countryside where the sort of idea of belonging to a particular sect was much stronger than in the towns. And you see exactly the same thing happening in Syria. In the demonstrations, there were lots of slogans. Same in Ukraine, we are one, we are anti-sectarianism, we believe in a political state. And then you got these sectarian entrepreneurs, very often funded by the Gulf, creating these militia groups, who again consisted of poor young men, often from the countryside, while the protest movement, like the protest movement in Bosnia, turned themselves into civil society. They started providing humanitarian aid, negotiating ceasefires, this kind of thing. And then I think what happens is that sectarianism is constructed through violence. And this is a very important part of my argument. All of us have multiple identities. The fact that we belong to, we're Serb, we're Croat, we're Muslim, we're Hindu, is not usually our most predominant identity. We're scholars, we're mothers, we're grandmothers, we're all sorts of, we're British, we're whatever. And it's only when somebody's trying to kill you and you're threatened with death because of who you are that sectarianism becomes the most dominant narrative. And I think that's what's really happens in wars, that you start with sectarian killings and gradually people turn to the side that's most likely to protect them, which is people of their own, and they gradually get imbued with sectarian narratives. Tactics. Again, the big change. In a lot of the literature on irregular war, there's a distinction drawn between guerrillas and terrorists. And guerrillas direct their attacks on strategic targets. Terrorists direct their attacks on non-combatants. New wars are definitely terrorist. New wars gain political control. That, like the guerrillas, their aim is political control. But unlike the guerrillas, they gain their political control usually by forcible displacement, by getting rid of anybody who challenges their political control, whether it's civil society groups or people of a different ethnicity. And forced displacement is the most typical tactic of new wars, whether it's through a whole series of tactics, killing a few people so that other people run away, sexual violence, the destruction of cultural heritage. All of these are the typical tactics of new wars, and I've written a lot about that, so I'm not going to go into that. One thing I want to add is about technology, because there's a lot of discussion about how technology is changing the way of war and how the introduction of information and communications technologies bring about a revolution in military affairs. And the question is, what about new wars? Are there technologies? And there definitely are technologies associated with new wars, and information and communications technologies are very important. They're important in an obvious sense that new wars are fought by loose networks that are really held together by the narrative and that are able to communicate with each other through the new technologies, whether it's mobile phones or social media. So communication is very crucial for the new networks. But also there are all kinds of tactics that are copied from war to war, like, for example, the use of improvised explosive devices, IEDs, which have improved over the years as new wars groups learn from each other. And they do actually make use, even though I tend to call this vernacular technology, because it's about using everyday available materials for military purposes, whether it's fertilizers or plastic bottles or whatever. But they often use very sophisticated triggering devices like mobile phones. So the new technology gets combined with these everyday available materials. And of course, the final difference is economic, which is that the civil wars, by and large, were financed by income from the socialist bloc. They got support from China, the Soviet Union, Cuba, and also taxation in the areas that they control. At both of those sources, well, the first source dried up after the end of the Cold War, and the second source, taxation, becomes incredibly difficult in the context of economic liberalisation. Tax revenues to the state drop dramatically, public spending drops, and in the context where control is maintained through maintaining disorder, it's terribly difficult to raise taxes. So what are the new sources of income? Of course, there are external donors, and this is very obvious in Syria, where you're getting external private donors very often from the Gulf. But you multiply that money by all sorts of domestic economic activities which are linked to violence. So it could be very obvious activities like loot, extortion at checkpoints, hostage taking. It can also be smuggling. And most wars have their own characteristic commodity that smuggled, drugs for Colombia or Afghanistan, oil and antiquities in Iraq and Syria, diamonds and oil in Angola. So that when you bring all these characteristics together, what you get is the establishment of what we might call hybrid authority, local authorities based on armed groups whose authority depends on perpetual disorder. And it's reproduced through the incentives to the armed groups. The reason why the armed groups go on fighting even though they can't win is because they actually benefit from the violence. And they benefit from the violence either politically, because it helps them to promote a sectarian narrative, which most people don't accept outside conditions of fear. Some people may do. And they benefit economically, because after a while, the economic activities become an end in themselves. I think you saw these changes in the Colombia case, both in terms of the nature of the revolutionary leadership and in terms of the economic sources that funded the wars, and in terms of the change in tactics, which became much more violent and anti-civilian once. So let me just, I should really end very soon, shouldn't I? I wanted to say a little bit about how new wars are changing, and I'll do that in a headline way. So I think what I was interested in my book was how it interacts with the other security cultures. And one thing I've developed is the idea of hybrid peace, which is not exactly the same as that developed by Oliver Richmond and McGuinty, although that's not inconsistent, which is what happens when you impose liberal peace, i.e. an international, top-down international peace agreement, just the sort of thing Annette's studying, with new wars. And what you get is a kind of entrenchment of the culture with less violence. They manage, in a way, the international community is guaranteeing hybrid authority at local levels, which allows them to continue their predatory activities. So that's how I could expand on that, but Bosnia is the perfect case. Then you can talk about hybrid war, which I think is both Ukraine and Syria, where you get either geopolitics or the war on terror intervening to greatly exacerbate the violence and the level of casualties. And I won't go into that. And then the final one is the combination of the war on terror with new wars, which was typical of Iraq and Afghanistan, and in my view, which is probably quite controversial, it actually produces jihadism. So I see ISIS as actually a product of what was effectively a new war in Iraq, superimposed on the war on terror. And I sort of speculate in the book about whether this represents yet a new culture, because ISIS are rather different from other new war groups. But I won't talk about that now. I just want to conclude by saying something about what is the utility of a culture's approach? Why is it worth doing? Well, in a very obvious sense, it's an alternative to the contest approach, in which the only answer is either winning or losing, or imposing a top-down political agreement. But also, I think once you see it as a culture, you can identify contradictions and dilemmas and irritants in the culture that might offer you different pathways for getting out of the culture. So, for example, if we think about new wars, I mean, I think one of the contradictions arises from the fact that they are globally integrated and we can't insulate ourselves from them, whether it's refugees, whether it's terrorism, or whether it's things like London property prices, which have risen so dramatically because it's a brilliant way of money laundering. So many of the most expensive houses in London are owned by Syrian warlords and Russian oligarchs. And so these kinds of effects on our own society do force us to think, not just to treat them as something over there, but force us to think about them. A second way in which is that actually predatory activities have limits, in the sense that predatory activities are unproductive. So once you've taken the assets of one particular area, you can't do it again and you have to move on. And so there are limits to how long you can sustain predatory activities. And that may mean that you have to shift to more productive activities, which then would shift the incentives. And a third is just public weariness that I think was terribly important in understanding why the bout of violence in Iraq in 2008-09 came to an end. And public weariness, I think, is also linked to what one might call irritants in the culture. And what do I mean by irritants? Well, I mean the heritage of those democratic movements, the civil society groups who are often the first to be targeted and who often get weaker as a result of new wars. Nevertheless, what you find all of these wars, the key characteristic in a way is that it's very fragmented and very decentralized. And it's always possible to find alternative places where the war has hardly touched. And there may be reasons for this. It may be that local people have negotiated ceasefires. It's extraordinary how many ceasefires have been negotiated in Syria. According to one count, 44 in the last year alone. It may be because, particularly in towns, people are absolutely desperate for clean water, electricity, fuel, and they have to negotiate local agreements to reach that. It may be just local people who are worried about the education of their children. There are all kinds of elements of what I call civicness that are to be found in new wars, always. But we never focus on them because we always focus on the violent event. And actually trying to think about and trying to map these might be an alternative way of trying to develop alternative cultures. And so I think the interesting thing about the cultural approach is that it gives you a whole different take on how you navigate away from traditional approaches to contests.